I again, people of marketing? Yes, you guessed it. This right here is a little ad. I'm not sure how much you know about Plannable, but we're a collaboration tool for social media teams, helping marketers around the world create, plan, review, approve, and schedule social media posts. The best part is that you can try Plannable for free, no strings attached. And if it strikes your fancy, we got a special offer just for you. Yes, I'm talking to you, dear listener who hasn't skipped past the ad. Go to plannable.io/listeners and use the discount code when upgrading to get 30% of the first 3 months. That is plannable.io/listeners. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the episode. Hey everyone, this is Ksenia Montan and welcome to another episode of People of Marketing Podcast. I'm the founder and CEO of Plannable, the collaboration tool for social teams, and I launched this podcast to take a sneak peek into the lives of top marketers. Every week, we explore the story of their careers, the choices, mistakes, wins, and imperfections of their work life. Today, we're going to take a sneak peek into the life of Abigail Cruz. She's the head of social for THG's beauty brands. For those out there who are not familiar with THG, the company owns several premium skincare and beauty lines such as Espa and Elamasqua, as well as Europe's number one online beauty retailer, Lookfantastic. Abigail leads the global strategy and implementation of over 25 social accounts across a portfolio of 9 beauty brands and counting. Abigail has 7 years of experience in the fashion and beauty industry, spanning from Sydney, her hometown, to London and now Manchester, where she's currently based. Abigail enjoys real-life stories on social, curated feeds, and going down the Reddit rabbit hole of threads. Abigail, thank you so much for joining me today on People of Marketing.
Thanks, Ksenia. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. So you have such an interesting background and such an interesting experience in the beauty and fashion industry. And I would love to learn more about it. And I think the best way to kickstart this conversation is just by, you know, walking through your career, trying to connect the dots. And first question that I have for you is, you know, do you remember what was your first interaction with marketing ever, maybe when you were a teenager or potentially even earlier than that? What got you into marketing in the first place?
That's such a good question. I guess my first interaction would have to be when I was 4 and I was hooked into, you know, Disney. I loved the franchise. And I was obsessed with the audiobook of Pocahontas, and my parents, poor things, they had to, they bought it for me, and I would always want to play it like in the car and listen to it over and over again. But I didn't know that would be like my first interaction, I guess, but I got so hooked on the franchise, and that was just, you know, my first step into marketing. But I guess if I think about it more, what really got me into marketing was probably the whole fashion magazines and the glamour of the publishing and the days, you know. I mean, I was such a fan of that. I don't know if you were too, just like looking through the old kind of Vogue magazines and looking at all the kind of glamorous like fashion shoots and things like that. And I just loved it, and it was something that I really wanted to be a part of, you know, someday, I thought. But yeah, that was, I would probably say that's my first sort of interaction into it.
So I would say it was a lot about the storytelling.
Yeah, 100%. I love a good story, as you said in your intro.
Yes, for sure. Did you study marketing? Did you study anything related to the industry you're currently in?
So I did a bachelor's degree in business, actually, and kind of majored in marketing. Oh, no, not some marketing. Management, actually. Yeah. But a lot of it was marketing modules, and a lot of it was around marketing. And I knew from the get-go when I started my bachelor's degree that I definitely didn't want to do kind of the finance and the kind of accounting side of business. And I was so much more interested in, the marketing side and the more people side, I guess, of business. And that's what kind of led me to this role. But yeah, there's a bit of connection in there, but I hadn't really learned about fashion marketing until my master's degree when I did fashion retail and luxury management, which is more kind of skewed towards marketing.
Got it. Walk us a little bit through your career journey. It all started in your hometown, Sydney, right?
Yeah.
So walk us through, you know, your both, you know, geographical, but also career journey.
Yeah, I know. I feel like I've been in both hemispheres, really, haven't I? But yeah, no, I think I guess my first job was after uni was actually in media. So I worked in an online youth media publication called Pedestrian TV. It's very similar to kind of Vice in its format and its layout. And to be honest, I fluked it in getting that job. I just kind of applied wherever I could after uni and landed this amazing, that we all do, and landed this amazing role. It was at its startup phase, so it was quite young. The team was really small, but I think that was a really great environment for me to kind of start my journey and my career, really, because you know, when you're fresh and young, and it's kind of nice to be able to have a bit of freedom to kind of just test what works, and but also have that guidance, I guess, from a managerial perspective, but still have that in a way autonomy to kind of own your job and own your role, because we were so small and at that stage. And I guess that was when I first kind of got my intro into social, because I was a community manager and editor at the time for the company. And that's when I started to kind of understand the value of social as a tool to talk to our audience, to communicate with them. It was really a good time, because you could really just understand what the audience were wanting. You could actually talk to them. It was really easy in terms of the back and forth. And that's where I kind of fell in love with social, I guess, and with the whole concept of social. And yeah, so that's what happened. I started there, and then I moved over to magazines, which was the, I guess, when we touch back on what my first sort of interaction with marketing was, it was all about, you know, the fashion mags and Fashion Land. And I got an amazing opportunity to work as a social media producer for Marie Claire and InStyle in Australia. And that's, you know, that was like a dream opportunity for me. And after the time there, it became pretty clear, you know, that social was the marketing space that I wanted to play in. It was what I really wanted to do and what I was really passionate about. And I soon kind of made steps after that to get to the brand side and diversify my experience. Because after that, I was, I'd always been in the kind of publisher side of things. And I never worked for a brand specifically, but I really wanted to get more knowledge and more experience that side. So I moved over to brand side when I decided to come to London to try it out, to see what opportunities kind of were there, and landed the role at Ted Baker as the global social lead, which was an amazing opportunity again, because I finally got to work in a brand and finally got to do what I love, which was kind of the blending of fashion and social together. And that was a great experience. But I guess this new role called at THG, it was a great opportunity to get into beauty and into the kind of, the beauty space essentially. And I couldn't say no, really. So here we are.
Wow. That's such a, I have so many questions. So
I tried to do a very quick summary of it, but yes. I know there's kind of questions. Yeah.
Yes. So first of all, you know, how did you decide, you know, to move hemispheres, you know, from one side of the world to another one? You know, I was thinking in the beginning when I looked at your profile that, you know, as it usually happens when you're working in media and you're working with advertisers, at some point you might switch ships and you might go and work for a client. That usually, you know, happens in the media industry, but also with agencies, but you didn't do that. You actually, you know, went across to a different country and purposefully looked for something else. So how did that decision came up?
Yeah, I guess, like, to me, I feel like I always knew I was going to end up in this side of the world, really, to be frank. I just, Australia is amazing and it has a lot of opportunities, but I always knew if it was going to be a point where I wanted to make it big in the fashion space, especially, that it had to kind of come from either Europe or the US. Yeah. And I just made a very conscious decision kind of early on, even in my kind of uni days, when I did my exchange, I did an exchange to London, and I knew that I really wanted to get amongst it. And I really wanted to kind of understand how marketing and how brands worked in this side of the world. And I think, yeah, very early on, it was a conscious decision to want to be here. But at the same time, it was just perfect timing, really, and being given the opportunity to after having had a bit of experience in Australia to be able to move over here and try it out. I think that also plays a huge part, because I, even though I wanted to move to London straight after graduating, realistically, the opportunities would have not been as big for me without that experience. But now, after doing that, the work there, and learning a bit more about marketing and being a bit more sure in myself, I was able to just try it out and do it. So I made the move. But yeah, I it's so cliche, but I just always kind of wanted to be here. I just knew in my head, I was like, the end goal was going to be here. And I mean, much to my parents' detriment, because I'm an only child. Oh, yeah. And their kids, you know, halfway across the world, I just always was like, Mom, Dad, I want to be here. And luckily they were super supportive of it. But yeah, no, I don't regret it. I think it was a amazing opportunity to be here. And it's something that I definitely, yeah, don't take for granted. And I'm so happy I did it. But yeah, it was a big move.
That is amazing. And you mentioned that it was the perfect timing to do so. It's talking about timing, you know, I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile and I see that you joined THG in September this year.
Yeah.
So a lot of people out there, you know, including myself as well, wouldn't make, you know, dramatic changes with their career. I mean, it's not dramatic. You're still in the same industry, but wouldn't make changes with their careers in the middle of a pandemic. So yeah. Where did you get that courage from?
Well, it's actually pretty funny you mentioned that, because when I first moved to, when I first thought about moving to London, the whole Brexit plans were put into place, and everyone was like, do you still want to go to London now after, you know, hearing about Brexit? So funny. And I was like, yeah. I was kind of like, yeah, why not? And I did the same thing now with like moving roles during.
You have a very weird definition of perfect timing.
Because in my head I was like, if not now, when, you know. True. It's I think it's so easy to kind of get so kind of settled and bogged down with timings and thinking, okay, if I do 5 years in this job, then I can move on to the next. If I have this level of experience, then I can do the next step. But realistically, it's, you know, opportunities don't work that way all the time. And sometimes it's just a matter of looking at it from a bigger picture perspective and thinking, you know what, it might not be the best of times from a world perspective, but
it feels right for you.
Yeah, exactly. And if you feel like it's an opportunity for you, if you feel like you resonate with what this new role is offering, and if it feels right for you, then why not? So I think it's been always my kind of mantra with it, where you kind of use your head and your heart with decisions like this. And I guess it pays off.
I love that. That's better than being stuck in analysis paralysis, which is what I usually do.
100%. So, yeah.
Good for you. I have a question around your, you know, around events and milestones in life. And it's kind of very specific questions, but let's give it a try. You know, we've all had this kind of like seemingly insignificant events, or they seemed insignificant at that point in time, that actually went on and completely changed our lives and, you know, became big milestones in our life. Did you have any, you know, random seemingly insignificant event like this?
I mean, I would say taking a job in media, to be honest, would be, I mean, you know, it doesn't seem very significant. Like it was quite a insignificant decision from my part, and I didn't necessarily actually want to be in media or create a career from it, frankly, but it really put me on a good path career wise and it taught me, you know, the fundamentals of what I now apply in every situation. And it's taught me to be nimble, it's taught me to be reactive, you know, with what's going on in the world, but to also, you know, discern and listen to my audience's reactions, what questions and info they want, you know, the whole fundamentals of social I learned through my first sort of experience in media and my first job out of uni. So if I hadn't done that, I don't think I would have really understood what it takes to be in social, to be honest, and I would have not really understood kind of how that, you know, that industry suits me personally. But I'm so glad that I did, because looking back, I'm like, I'm grateful that it opened those windows of opportunity for me. But also from a logistical point of view, it's like I was able to understand what social actually means from working in that job in media. So I wouldn't have thought that could happen, really. But right. Yeah,
you didn't expect it to shape your entire career.
definitely didn't think that would be the case. It's right. You know how people talk about how you know, you shift industries or you shift careers like six or seven times in your lifetime. I thought that I would be that type of person where I didn't think that my first job out of uni would end up kind of being the bread and butter for what I do now. And it actually has. So I'm just like, oh, wow. That's it's quite interesting thinking back that way.
Why is there a dead elephant on our t-shirts that people keep buying? Well, it's because an elephant dies every 15 minutes. That's something that most people don't know. And they hear that in our marketing. They're like, what? Every 15 minutes? That's not even an episode of something on Netflix.
That was Christian from Mountain Talking, who just made our social team's 100 top. You can check out the list at planable.io/social teams 100. That's planable.io/social teams 100. Enjoy the rest of the episode. And what do you think about like the future? Do you think you're going to change or switch, you know, industries?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I've found, in terms of industry, I think I've found the sweet spot. Like I love beauty. I thought it would be fashion, to be honest. But I'm never going to be never say no in this situation. I think there's always opportunities, but I really enjoy beauty from a personal level, but also from a opportunity level. I feel like the industry and the beauty space is ever evolving, and there's so many kind of stories within beauty, so many opportunities from a tech perspective, and I love that sort of ability that the industry has to progress, and I definitely think I found that. In terms of role, I think social is ever evolving, to be honest. I think it's only one part of marketing, and this is only one reiteration of it now, but social could be something completely different in the next sort of 10, 20 years. So I don't know if I'll be in social per se, but I'll definitely be kind of wanting to be part of that conversation, whatever it looks like from a marketing perspective, where we are kind of telling stories and we are reaching audiences and we're talking to them and we're communicating with them in the most personal and intimate way. To me, that's where I still want to be.
Well, yeah, So we talked about the past a little bit, and now we talked a little bit about the future. And I want to zoom in on the present. So tell us a little bit about what it actually means to be the global head of social at THD for the beauty brands. What, you know, does a typical day look like in your work life? What's the first thing you tackle when you start your day? You know, what does your week look like, basically? Tell us a little bit about that.
I mean, there's no typical day, as cliche as it sounds.
I can imagine.
I do like so much, but in the best way, I think it suits me because I do love kind of having variation, but also routine. It's quite paradoxical, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I do like having the routine of, you know, checking in with my team. I go through my emails. I create a to-do list from it. I always make sure that I have a to-do list and I have an agenda of things that I want to achieve in the day. But I also always focus on tackling kind of yesterday's problems. Like, I hate starting the day without, you know, having addressed something that's still lingering, or like if it's the outcome of a frustrating call or having a meeting that I still don't have any clarity on. I like to really address that from the get-go, because I don't like kind of problems or kind of misunderstandings start to pile up. But yeah, I love having a clear day, or starting my day with kind of a clear sort of agenda and a clear thought to it, and an intention, really. But yeah, in terms of a typical kind of day, it really does vary, because you know, with social, you touch on so many touch points. You talk to so many sort of different teams within the division of marketing. You know, there's everything from planning what we're going to be doing from a future perspective, but then also analyzing what we've done and how to do it better. And then there's the present of, you know, what's the social listening? What are people talking about? What's trending? How do we get involved? It's very much a past, present, future process for me when it comes to a day-to-day. When it comes to day-to-day. But, you know, I enjoy it. I love that sort of mentality, I guess, and sort of process with work.
Do you have any, like, I imagine it must be a very hectic type of work life. How do you maintain a productive week? Do you have any like tips and tricks on getting the most out of your day, you know, staying focused? I imagine lots of meetings are happening, especially now. Zoom to SIG is a thing. So, you know, any advice or any learnings to stay focused and productive?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, burnout is so real in our industry, isn't it? It's a very real thing. And when I was starting, I used to always absorb everything. You know, once if my boss was like, "Can you do something?" I'd be like, "Yep, I can do it," because I wanted to prove that I could do it. And it's a nice, you know, of course it's nice to be eager, and it's a good quality to have. But at the end of the day, I think learning to not spread yourself thin, and also kind of delegating work, and also delegating work for yourself, whether that's just, you know, you're not managing anyone and you're just managing your workload, to delegating if you've got, you know, other members in your team. I think it's so important to be quite clear about what you can actually do in a day, and really break it down and look at it in chunks, and be like, okay, what can I actually do today? What's my priorities? What do I need to actually get out of the way? For me, doing it with to-do lists are very helpful. I'm quite a list person, so I like to write it down.
I love lists. I love making lists. I love crossing lists.
It gives me
such a high.
You and I are quite the same in that way.
I love
a list. So for me, it's everything to do with, I'll write a list of what I need to do today. I'll have a look at what urgently needs to be done, and then kind of tear it out in a way where it's what's the stuff that isn't as important. Mm-hmm. And just compartmentalize it a little bit, give it a bit more of a tangible, measurable kind of action towards it, rather than just feeling like you're quite overwhelmed because you've got 100 things on your to-do list and you don't know where to start. And I think it also helps to really break away and take time to take breaks throughout the day.
That's
especially
so important,
as exactly, especially as you mentioned with working from home now, it's so easy because your workspace is your home space at the same time, that it's so easy to kind of be doing all your work and feel like you need to just, you know, sit there all day and do what you need to do, and you forget that you need to take time to stand up and just have a few steps around the room or just take a break and have a tea. You forget all those things that you sometimes did when you were in the office, like a post-lunch walk or something like that. You don't really get to do now just because it's just a different environment, I guess, in a different situation. But I really stress that on my team, and I really do dedicate time to take a break, because rest is so essential, and it all just kind of comes back to that burnout kind of topic. Yeah. Where it's like you don't want to burn out, and you're no kind of good to a team when you're stressed and when you're not able to focus. So in able to do that, you need to take a break and prioritize yourself and work well and work how you want to work, but also dedicate that time to rest. Yeah,
I love that. I remember I think the CMO of Burger King tweeted something very funny once. I think, you know, in May or June, he said something like, I can't wait to get back to work so I can get less done.
Oh my gosh, it's so true.
Yes. So true and so sad. But yes, I resonated so much with this, because you are so glued to your laptop when you're at home. You just, you know, you forget to have, you know, those, you know, chats with people and to take a little bit of a break. And, you know, long term, it's just not healthy at all. I wanted to ask, you know, being the global head of social and having, you know, progressed so much in your career, is there anything you miss that you don't get to do as much now that you're in, you know, in a leadership position?
I would say that I miss writing copy, actually. Like I enjoy writing in general. It used to be always kind of like a little hobby of mine. So I do miss kind of creating posts sometimes, because you're now in the leadership position, as you say, like a lot of it is strategy. A lot of it is kind of forward planning, and less time is put into actually kind of implementing, because you've got a great team that supports you in that way. So I do miss that, actually. And I miss kind of getting a little bit of that high or that recognition when someone kind of calls you out on social and is like, I love that post, or whoever that social media manager is, like, I love them, they're so funny. Like, you miss kind of getting that appreciation from people and your audience that you don't know, but you just, you kind of resonate and you kind of get along with without it ever having met them. And I don't really get that opportunity so much these days, but yeah, I do miss that part of it.
Mm. Talking about social media posts and actually, you know, writing them and you know, being behind the social media account, I'm curious, you know, following dozens of social media accounts must be part of the job description, probably. We all have our favorite social media accounts out there. So, you know, the person behind what, you know, social media account, or what, you know, Twitter account, Facebook, Instagram account would you love to meet?
Oh, well, there is so many, as you said, because there's so many social media accounts. It's funny that you mentioned the is it the CMO or the CLM of Burger King? Because I said Burger King, I'd love to meet the person behind the socials for them, because they're just so funny and so witty. Yeah. And I low key love a good old fashioned kind of Twitter war with brands, and they always respond to each other and kind of outwit each other.
That
so you know, it's so funny to watch. So, like, you know, Burger King's a culprit. Wendy's do so well. Netflix, all those brands. Like, I love, I love looking at their tweets. I'd always be curious to see who that person is behind the accounts. And I always think it's so risky to be, you know, sassy and self-deprecating as a brand on any social platform. But, you know, they nail it. So kudos to them. I feel like I you know, that job and that role isn't, it's quite hard, right? It's not everyone's sort of cup of tea, but they do so well. So I'd love to meet those types of people.
It's interesting how these accounts that you're mentioning are mostly like in the FMCG and the tech mm-hmm. space. You don't see that many fashion or beauty brands being greedy and sassy, right?
Yeah. wrong. Yeah, you're right. Like there's obviously, I think with a lot of Gen Z and sort of younger fashion brands and younger mm-hmm. beauty brands, you're starting to see it more because obviously demo are kind of people that have grown up on social or grown up with social. And so they're so used to seeing brands speak to them as if they were their best friend or behave as if they were, yeah, their best friend. So they're kind of used to that sassy kind of attitude on social, or they're used to kind of the informal, friendly way of speaking. But I think it's still quite rare for more sort of premium brands and more kind of, yeah, the older school kind of beauty brands to speak like that, because it is quite different, and you still have to kind of maintain that I guess brand identity and right. brand image, where you're still having to be quite credible, and sometimes social isn't the kind of platform for you to be sassy just because everyone else is doing it, but instead it's might be an educational avenue or something, or it's more of a customer service account. Like it's not necessarily just because everyone's sassy or that's what's trending that you should also be like that on social. So I agree. I think it's not as common as the FMCG sort of brands that you see on social behaving that way.
That's great advice. You know, don't do things that others are doing just because it's trendy and it's a thing.
Yeah.
You gotta follow and build your own brand. And you know, that actually takes me to my next question. Social media people and just marketers in general, we talk a lot about things that go well, right? These accounts that, you know, are witty and are winning at it. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, is there a campaign or potentially a work project that you'd like to do over or to get another spin at it?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. I feel like I don't get asked that often. It's not something that gets asked often, which is actually good because it makes you kind of think, you're like, which ones would I do over? Mm-hmm. I think for me, I feel like I'd like to have dealt with addressing BLM on social in my last role again. I think it was such an important topic, you know, in general, you know, from a global scale. And for someone working in social, like it really shed light on which brands were talking about it authentically, you know, because it's always been part of the business mandate versus kind of, you know, the brands that needed to respond because it, you know, it was a reactive moment. And I think, for me, I feel like it wasn't, you know, I don't want to kind of, in a way, disrespect like the role of the brand, but I think right. it kind of really shook us a little bit in terms of how do we respond to what's going around the world and what people are saying. And I think in retrospect, it would have been better to kind of actually look inwards and be like, you know, this issue, how are we tackling this internally as a brand and as a company, instead of just responding to what people are saying or are asking to hear in a way. Mm. But yeah, it's such a tricky one with things that kind of have a social sort of lens on it, and it involves a lot of people. It isn't just a brand, you know, marketing something. It's actually a social justice issue. It's a human issue. I think that's when it gets a bit tricky, because you don't know whether a brand, you know, has a place to say anything whether they should be saying anything. But yeah, it was a tricky one, and it's something that I don't necessarily want to do over, and I say with inverted commas, but perhaps it's something that will make me think about how I approach social issues or kind of bigger, wider global issues in this new role and how we address that in social.
That's amazing. And I can't agree more with you. I think it kind of needs to start from the company's culture, right?
Yes, yes, totally.
Its own internal practices, everything that happens inside. It's not just the point of view. It actually needs to be, you know, at the core. Because, you know, the audience has a smell for those things. So it like authenticity.
Yes, that's so true.
There. So I could probably talk forever to you, literally.
Same. It's been quite nice.
I have one more question before we wrap up with our rapid fire session. And it's also a bit of a controversial. We're touching on a lot of hot topics today with you.
I know, I feel like it. No, I love it though.
Yeah, me too. So I want to ask you, you know, this industry being so dynamic and so ever-changing, and there's so many trends every single day, you know, what is one buzzword or one trend or like a popular thing in marketing or in social media today that you disagree with, that is annoying you, or that you think is like totally massively overrated?
Another good question. This one's great. I hate the term repurposing content. I think that is one of my biggest pet peeves. It's not really a buzzword, but you hear it so much.
It's a thing, yeah.
And I know, you know, some instances call for it, but I just hate it, you know, when they create a campaign or any content in general, and it's just created with this vision of, hey, we'll just repurpose it on all the other channels, or let's create this one video or one asset and let's repurpose it so it, you know, seems cost effective, but in reality it just takes time and it wastes people's time really to try to create something that was never intended to be created for their channels. And I think social is definitely a repeat victim of repurposing content. I think in my whole kind of career, I've really seen it where sometimes companies just don't get it, or creative teams don't get it, or just something's out of balance, where you've got an amazing sort of campaign and you've got an amazing sort of vision of what you want to do, but then in the end, when it comes to implementing, they'll just create one video and be like, yeah, that's that. You can do that for social and you can put that on a banner. And I'm always like, what? Like in my head, I'm kind of like, if it needs to happen, like, you know, if you really want it to be social first, which is also another buzzword in itself, but if you really want it to kind of engage on social, it needs to be created for the purpose of social. Like there's no point in trying to do a one size fits all approach with content. And yeah, it's just something that I hate. I'm always just like, when I hear someone say, oh, we've got all these assets, it's not really for social, but you can repurpose it, right? I'm like, oh gosh, I'm like gritting my teeth.
So funny, and such an interesting one. It has never come up on the show.
Really?
Because, you know, yeah, like, you know, being buzzwords and being trends, some of them repeat themselves. But this is the first time someone is mentioning repurposing content. And now that you're explaining it and going through your logic, I am guilty of this one. I have to say I am. But it kind of made me think about it. So I might sleep on it. So I have three rapid fire questions for you. So quick questions, quick answers. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
Good. So first one is, you know, what is your personally favorite social media network? Where do you hang out the most?
Oh my gosh. I would say Reddit, because I said that.
Yes, you did. Yes, Reddit. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. What's your favorite app or tool that, you know, you use at work?
Oh, I'd have to say Microsoft Teams, because, you know, I hate waiting for replies on emails, and I love the GIF option. I always use GIF. So that's
a good one. And my last question is, if you wouldn't be doing what you're doing today, what else would you do?
I'd have to say singing or writing.
Singing.
I've done it since I was little. And the same with writing. I love anything creative, so that's what I'd be doing. Preferably in a warm place too, because I, you know, I'm Aussie at heart, so I love the sun.
Yeah, Manchester is not that sunny, right?
No, it's a bit of the opposite.
Yes, it is. Yes. But it does have a lot of, you know, singing. It kind of is, you know, the city with a lot of history in that regard. So maybe, who knows?
Exactly.
Abigail, thank you so much for taking the time to just share your story, share your journey. I really, really enjoyed it. Had a blast chatting with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Ksenia. I had such a great time chatting with you too.
Yeah. And for everyone else listening in, thank you for joining. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, we have new ones every Wednesday. Subscribe to People of Marketing on your favorite podcast app. Until next time.